well, which she'd been in denial about for quite some time. It doesn't matter what. My program's my own. The hiding the car keys, the cutting off her credit with different dentists, the checking the wastebaskets for new brush wrappers 5 times an hour. My unmanageability's my own, and I'm doing what I can, day by day, to let go and detach with love.
I think I understand.
I'm working 9 now.
Pat said, the 9th step.
The ADA reversed the hat's rotation by moving his fingers in the opposite direction along the brim.
I'm trying to make direct amends to whosoever my 4th and 8th step works revealed I've harmed, except in cases where to do so would injure them or others.
A tiny spiritual slip from Pat in the form of a patronizing smile.
I have a nodding acquaintance with 9 myself.
The ADA was barely there, his eyes fixed and dilated. The remorselessly ingathered eyebrow angle Pat had always seen in his photos was completely reversed. The brows now formed a little peaked roof of pathos.
One of your residents, he said, a Mr. Gately, court remanded out of the 5th Circuit, Peabody, I believe, or staff counselor, alumni, some status.
Pat made a kind of exaggerated innocent trying to place the name type face. The ADA said,
it doesn't matter. I'm aware of your constraints. I want nothing from you on him. It's him I've been up at St. Elizabeth's to see.
Pat allowed herself one slightly flared nostril at this news. The ADA leaned forward, hat rotating between his calves, elbows on knees, and the odd defecatory posture men used to try to communicate earnestness in their sharing.
I'm told I owe the Mr. Gately an amend. I need to make an amend to Mr. Gately.
He looked up.
You too. This remains within these walls as if it were my anonymity, all right?
Yes.
It doesn't matter what for. I've harbored a resentment against this Gately concerning an incident I'd considered responsible for making Tootie's phobia reflare. It doesn't matter the specifics or his culpability or exposure to prosecution in the incident. I've come to believe these don't matter. I've harbored this resentment. The kid's picture's been up on my priority board with the pictures of far more objectively important threats to the public weal. I've been biding my time, waiting to get him. This latest incident... No, don't say it. You needn't say a thing. Seemed like just the opening. My last chance went federal, and then fizzled.
Pat allowed herself a very slightly puzzled forehead. The man waved the hat.
It doesn't matter. I've hated this man. You know that Enfield's Suffolk County. This incident with the Canadian assault, the alleged firearm, the witnesses who can't depose because of their own exposure. My sponsor, my entire group. They say if I act on the resentment, I'm doomed. I'll get no relief. It won't help Tootie. Tootie's lips will still be white pulp from the peroxide, or enamel in tatters from the constant irrational brushing and brushing and brushing and...
He clapped his fine, clean hand over his mouth and produced a high-pitched noise that, frankly, gave Pat the howlers, his right eyelid twitching. He took several breaths.
I need to let it go. I've come to believe that. Not just the prosecution, that's the easy part. I've already tossed the file, though whatever civil liability the Mr. Gately might face is another matter. Not my concern. It's so damnably ironic. The man's going to two-step out of, at the very least, a probation violation and prosecution on all his old, highly convictable charges. Because I have to pitch the case for the sake of my own recovery. I, who wanted nothing so much as to see this man locked down in a cell with some psychopathic cellmate for the rest of his natural life, who shook my fist at the ceiling and vowed...
And again, the noise. This time muffled by the fine hat, and so less well muffled. His shoes pounding a little on the carpet in rage, so that Pat's dogs raised their heads and looked quizzically at him, and the epileptic one had a very small, loud noise seizure.
I hear you saying this is very hard, that you have decided what you need to do.
Worse, the ADA said, blotting his brow with an unfolded handkerchief. I have to make an amend, my sponsor said. If I want the growth that promises real relief, I have to make direct amends, put out my hand and say that I'm sorry, and ask the man's forgiveness for my own failure to forgive. This is the only way I'll be able to forgive him. And I can't detach with love from Tootie's phobic compulsion until I've forgiven the man I've blamed in my heart.
Pat looked him in the eye.
Of course I can't say I've tossed the Canadian cases file. I needn't go that far, they say. That would expose me to conflict of interest, the irony. And could hurt Tootie, if my position's threatened. I've been told I can simply let him simmer on that until time passes and nothing moves forward.
He raised his own eyes.
Which means you cannot tell anyone either. Declining to prosecute for personal spiritual reasons, the office, it would be hard for others to understand. This is why I've come to you, in explicit confidence.
I hear your request, and I'll honor it.
But listen, I can't do it. Cannot. I've sat outside that hospital room, saying the Serenity Prayer over and over, and praying for willingness, and thinking of my own spiritual interests, and believing this amend is my higher power's will for my own growth, and I haven't been able to go in. I go and sit, paralyzed, outside the room for several hours, and drive home, and pry Tootie away from the sink. It can't go on. I have to look that rotten, no, evil. I'm convinced in my heart that son of a bitch is evil and deserves to be removed from the community. I have to walk in there and extend my hand and tell him I've wished him ill and blamed him and ask for forgiveness. Him! If you knew what sick, twisted, sadistically evil and sick thing he did to us, to her, and ask him for forgiveness. Whether he forgives or not is not the issue. It's my own side of the street I need to clean.
It sounds very, very hard, Pat said.
The fine hat was almost spinning between the man's calves, the pant cuffs of which had been pulled up in the defecatory forward lean to reveal socks that weren't, it seemed, both quite the same texture of wool. The mismatched socks spoke to Pat's heart more than anything else.
I don't even know why I came here, he said. I couldn't simply leave again and drive home. Yesterday she'd been at her tongue with one of those old no-coat lingua scraper appliances until it bled. I can't go home and look on that again without having cleaned house.
I hear you.
And you were just down the hill.
I understand.
I don't expect help or counsel. I already believe I have to do it. I've accepted the injunction to do it. I believe I have no choice, but I can't do it. I haven't been able to do it.
Willing, maybe.
Haven't yet been willing. Yet. I wish to emphasize, yet.
The 20th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, immediately pre-fundraiser exhibition fete. Gaudiomus igitur. Usually, part of the experience of having the place you live in throw a gala is watching different people arrive for the festivities. The war shavers, the Gartons, and Pendelsons, and Prines, the Chins, the Middlebrooks, and Gelbs. An incidental Lowell, the Buckmans in their claret-colored Volvo, driven by their silent grown son, who you never see except when he's driving Kirk and Benny Buckman someplace. Dr. Hickel and his creepy niece. The Chawuffs and Heavens. The Rehoggins. The palsied and mega-wealthy Mrs. Warshaver with her pair of designer canes. The Donegan brothers from Svelte Nail. But usually we never get to see them arriving, the friends and patrons of ETA, for the fundraising exhibition and gala. Usually while they're arriving and getting greeted by Tavis, we're all down in the lockers, dressing and stretching, getting ready to exhibit, getting shaved and taped by Loach, etc. It must usually be an unusual occasion for the guests, too, because for the first few hours, they're there to watch us play, they're all audience. Then at some point, with the last couple matches winding down, the guys in white jackets with trays start appearing in ComEd, and the gala starts, and then it's the guests who become the participants and performers. Dressing and stretching, wrapping grips with Gauzetex, or filling a pouch with Fuller's Earth, Coil, Freer, Stice, Traub, or Sawdust, Wagenknecht, Chew. Getting taped, those in puberty getting shaved and taped. A ritual. Even the conversation, usually, such as it is, has a timeless ceremonial aspect. John Wayne, hunched, as always, on the bench before his locker with his towel like a hood over his head, running a coin back and forth over the backs of his fingers. Shaw pinching the flesh between his thumb and first finger. Acupressure for a headache. Everyone had gone into their, like, autopilot ritual. Postlethwaite's sneakers were pigeon-toed under a stall door. Khan was trying to spin a tennis ball on his finger like a basketball. At the sink, Elliot Cornspan was blowing out his sinuses with hot water. No one else was anywhere near the sink. A certain number of hysterical pre-competition rumors about the Quebec junior team and the severity of the weather circulated and were refuted and shifted antigens and returned. You could hear the high register end of the wind even down here. The Chikmensei kid was doing a kind of piefe in place, his knees hitting his chest, stretching his hip flexors out. Trolch sat up against his locker near Wayne, wearing a disconnected headset and broadcasting his own match in advance. There were fart accusations and denials. Raider snapped a towel at Wagenknecht, who liked to stand for long periods of time bent at the waist with his head against his knees. Arslanian sat very still in a corner, blindfolded in what was either an ascot or a very fey necktie, his head cocked in the attitude of the blind. It was unclear whether B squads would even get to play. No one was sure how many courts the MIT Union had inside. Rumors flew this way and that. Michael Pemulis was nowhere to be seen since early this AM, at which time Anton Duchette said he'd seen Pemulis, quote, lurking out by the West House dumpsters, looking, quote, anxiously depressed. Then a small but univocal cheer went up from some of the players when Otis P. Lord appeared at the door, his cadaverous dad escorting him, OPL, out of post-op, and pale but looking his old self, with just a thin little choker-width bandage of gauze around his neck from the monitor's removal, and an odd ellipse of dry red skin around his mouth and nostrils. He came in and shook a few hands, and used the stall next to Postlethwaite, and left. He wasn't playing today. J.L. Strzok was applying an astringent to areas of his jaw. An hysterical rumor that the Quebec players had been spotted coming down a ramp out of a charter bus in the main lot, and were, by all appearances, not the Quebec JDC and WC squads, but some sort of special Olympic-ish Quebec adult wheelchair tennis contingent. This rumor flew wildly around the locker room and then died out when a couple of the sub-14s who burned nervous energy by scampering around checking rumors scampered out and up the stairs to check the rumor and failed to return. Across the wall on the female side, we could easily hear Thode and Donnie Stott invoking Camilla, goddess of speed and light step. Thode had had an hysterical tantrum after breakfast because Poutrincourt hadn't showed for the female's pre-match staff thing and looked to be AWOL. Loach and others had outfitted Ted Schacht with a complex knee brace, with jointed aluminum struts down both sides and a coin-sized hole in the elastic over the kneecap for dermal ventilation, and Schacht was lumbering around between the stalls and the locker with his arms straight out and his weight on his heels, pretending to walk like Frankenstein. Several people talked to themselves at their lockers. Barry Loach was down on one knee, shaving Hal's left ankle for tape.
A couple of us remarked how Hal wasn't eating the usual customary Snickers bar or Amino Pal. Hal had his hands on Loach's shoulders as the tape went on. A match wrap is two horizontal layers just above the malleolus knob thing, then straight down, and four times around the tarsus, just in front of the joint. So there's a big gap for flexion of the joint, but a compacting and supportive wrap. Then Loach puts a liner sock and a wick sock over the tape, then slides on the little inflatable air cast deal and pumps it to the right pressure, checking with a little gauge, and Velcros it just tight enough for support plus max flexion. Hal was on the bench with his hands on Loach's shoulders through the whole little routine. Everybody's had his hands on Loach's shoulders at one time or another. Hal's shave and wrap take 4 minutes. Schacht's knee and Fran Unwin's hamstring thing each take over 10. Wayne's quarter looked like it was dancing on his knuckles. Because of the towel over his head, all you could see was a very thin oval section of his face, like an almond on its end. Wayne got to have a small disc player in his locker, and Joni Mitchell was playing, which nobody ever minded because he kept it very low. Stice was blowing a purple bubble. Freer was trying to touch his toes. Traub and Whale, also on the rap bench, later said Hal was being weird. Like they said, asking Loach, if the pre-match locker room ever gave him a weird feeling. Occluded. Electric. As if all this had been done and said so many times before, it made you feel it was recorded. They all in here existed basically as Fourier transforms of postures and little routines. Locked down and stored and call upable for rebroadcast at specific times. What Traub heard as Fourier transforms, Whale heard as Fourier transforms. But also, as a consequence, erasable, Hal had said. By whom? Hal, before a match, usually had a wide-eyed, ingenuish anxiety of someone who'd never been in a situation even remotely like this before. His face today had assumed various expressions, ranging from distended hilarity to scrunched grimace, expressions that seemed unconnected to anything that was going on. The word was that Tavis and Stitt had chartered 3 buses to take the squads to an indoor venue. Mrs. Inc. had had alumnus Corbett Thorpe call in mammoth favors to arrange. Several mostly unused courts, somewhere in the deep brain tissue of the MIT Student Union, and that the whole gala would be moved over to the Student Union, and that the Quebec team, and most of the guests, were being contacted by cellular about the cancellation of the previous cancellation and the change in venue, and that those guests who didn't hear about the change would ride in the buses with the players and staff, some of them in formal and evening wear, probably, the guests. Traub also says he also heard Hal use the word moribund, but Whale couldn't confirm. Schacht entered a stall and drove the latch home with a certain purposeful sound that produced that momentary gunslinger-enters-saloon-type hush throughout the locker room. Nobody in the vicinity could say they heard Barry Loach respond one way or another to any of the strange, moody things Hal was saying as Loach locked down the ankle for high-level play. Wagenknecht, apparently, really did fart. The consensus among ETAs is that head trainer Barry Loach resembles a wingless fly, blunt and scuttly, etc. One ETA tradition consists of big buddies recounting to new or very young little buddies the saga of Loach and how he ended up as an elite head trainer, even though he doesn't have an official degree in training or whatever from Boston College, which is where he'd gone to school. In outline form, the saga goes that Loach grew up as the youngest child of an enormous Catholic family, the parents of which were staunch Catholics of the old school of extremely staunch Catholicism, and that Mrs. Loach, as in the mom's life's most fervent wish, was that one of her countless children would enter the RC clergy, but that the eldest Loach boy had done a 2-year USN bit and had gotten demapped early on in the Brazilian ONAN/UN joint action of YTMP. And that within weeks of the wake, the next oldest Loach boy had died of sequitoxic food poisoning, eating tainted blackfin grouper. And the next oldest Loach, Therese, through a series of adolescent misadventures, had ended up in Atlantic City, New Jersey, as one of the women in sequined leotards and high heels who carries a large poster board card with the round number on it around the ring between rounds of professional fights.
so that hopes for Therese becoming a Carmelite dimmed considerably. And on down the line, one loach falling helplessly in love and marrying right out of high school, another burning only to play the cymbals with a first-rate Philharmonic, now crashing away with the Houston Philharmonic Orchestra, and so on, until there was just one other Loach child, and then Barry Loach, who was the youngest and also totally under Mrs. L.'s thumb emotionally, and that young Barry had breathed a huge sigh of relief when his older brother, always a pious and contemplative and big-hearted kid, brimming over with abstract love and an innate faith in the indwelling goodness of all men's souls, began to show evidence of a true spiritual calling to a life of service in the R.C. clergy, and ultimately entered Jesuit seminary, removing an enormous weight from his younger brother's psyche, because young Barry, ever since he first slapped a Band-Aid on an X-Men figure, felt his true calling was not to the priesthood, but to the liniment and adhesive ministry of professional athletic training. Who finally can say the whys and whences of each man's true vocation? And then, so Barry was a training major, or whatever, at BC, and by all accounts proceeding satisfactorily toward a degree, when his older brother, quite far along toward getting ordained, or frocked, or whatever, as a licensed Jesuit, suffered, at age 25, a sudden and dire spiritual decline, in which his basic faith in the innate, indwelling goodness of men, like, spontaneously combusted and disappeared, and for no apparent or dramatic reason. It just seemed as if the brother had suddenly contracted a black, misanthropic spiritual outlook, the way some 25-year-old men contract Sanger-Brown's ataxia, or MS, a kind of degenerative Lou Gehrig's disease of the spirit. And his interest in serving man, and God in man, and nurturing the indwelling Christ in people through Jesuitical pursuits, underwent an understandable nosedive. And he began to do nothing but sit in his dormitory room at St. John's Seminary, right near Enfield Tennis Academy, coincidentally, on Foster Street in Brighton off Com Ave, right by the Archdiocese HQ, or whatever, sitting there, trying to pitch playing cards into a wastebasket in the middle of the floor, not going to classes or vespers or reading his hours, and talking, frankly, about giving up the vocation altogether, which all had Mrs. Loach just about prostrate with disappointment, and had young Barry suddenly reweighted with dread and anxiety, because if his brother bailed out of the clergy, it would be nearly irresistibly incumbent on Barry, the very last Loach, to give up his true vocation of splints and flexion and enter seminary himself to keep his staunch and beloved mom from dying of disappointment. And so a series of personal interviews with the spiritually necrotic brother took place, Barry having to station himself on the other side of the playing cards wastebasket so as even to get the older brother's attention, trying to talk the brother down from the misanthropic spiritual ledge he was on. The spiritually ill brother was fairly cynical about Barry Loach's reasons for trying to talk him down, seeing as how both men knew that Barry's own career dreams were on the line here as well. Though the brother smiled sardonically and said he'd come to expect little better than self-interested, number one, looking out from human beings anyway, since his practicum work out among the human flocks in some of Boston's nastier downtown venues, the impossibility of conditions changing, the ingratitude of the low-life homeless addicted and mentally ill flocks he served, and the utter lack of compassion and basic help from the citizenry at large in all Jesuitical endeavors, had killed whatever spark of inspired faith he'd had in the higher possibilities and perfectibility of man. So, he opined, what should he expect but that his own little brother, no less than the coldest commuter passing the outstretched hands of the homeless and needy at Park Street Station, should be all too humanly concerned with nothing but the care and feeding of numero uno. Since a basic absence of empathy and compassion and taking the risk to reach out seemed to him now an ineluctable part of the human character. Barry Loach was understandably way out of his depth on the theological turf of, like, apologia and the redeemability of man, Though he was able to relieve a slight hitch in the brother's toss that was stressing his card-throwing arm's flexor carpi ulnaris muscle, and so to up the brother's card-in-wastebasket percentage significantly, but he was not only desperate to preserve his mother's dream and his own indirectly athletic ambitions at the same time, he was actually, rather, a spiritually upbeat guy, who just didn't buy the brother's sudden despair at the apparent absence of compassion and warmth in God's supposed self-mimetic and divine creation. And he managed to engage the brother in some rather heated and high-level debates on spirituality and the soul's potential, not that much unlike Aloysia and Ivan's conversations in the good old Brothers K, though probably not nearly as erudite and literary, and nothing from the older brother even approaching the carcinogenic acerbity of Ivan's Grand Inquisitor scenario. In outline, it eventually boiled down to this. A desperate Barry Loach, with Mrs. L now on 25 milligrams of daily Ativan,
384,
and just about camped out in front of the candlelighting apse of the Loach's parish church, Loach challenges his brother to let him prove somehow, risking his own time, Barry's, and maybe safety somehow, that the basic human character wasn't as unempathetic and necrotic as the brother's present depressed condition was leading him to think. After a few suggestions and rejections of bets to weigh out even for Barry Loach's desperation, the brothers finally settle on a, like, experimental challenge. The spiritually despondent brother basically challenges Barry Loach to not shower or change clothes for a while and make himself look homeless and disreputable and louse-ridden and clearly in need of basic human charity, and to stand out in front of the Park Street T station on the edge of the Boston Common, right alongside the rest of the downtown community's lumpen dregs, who all usually stood there outside the T station, stemming change, and for Barry Loach to hold out his unclean hand and instead of stemming change, simply ask passers-by to touch him. Just to touch him. Namely, extend some basic human warmth and contact. And this, Barry does. And does. Days go by. His own spiritually upbeat constitution starts taking blows to the solar plexus. It's not clear whether the verminousness of his appearance had that much to do with it. It just turned out that standing there outside the station doors and holding out his hand and asking people to touch him ensured that just about the last thing any passerby in his right mind would want to do was touch him. It's possible that the respectable citizenry with their book bags and cellulars and dogs with little red sweater vests thought that sticking one's hand way out and crying, "Touch me, just touch me, please," was some kind of new stem-type argot for lay some change on me, because Barry Loach found himself hauling in a rather impressive daily total of dollars, significantly more than he was earning at his work-study job, wrapping ankles and sterilizing dental prostheses for Boston College lacrosse players. Citizens found his pitch apparently just touching enough to give him dollars. But Barry Loach's brother, who often stood there in collarless mufti up against the plastic jamb of the T station's exit, slouched and smirking, and idly shuffling a deck of cards in his hands, was always quick to point out the spastic delicacy with which the patrons dropped change or dollars into Barry Loach's hand. These kind of bullwhip motions or jagged in and outs, like they were trying to get something hot off a burner, never touching him. And they rarely broke stride or even made eye contact as they tossed alms BL's way. Much less ever getting their hand anywhere close to contact with BL's disreputable hand. The brother, not unreasonably, nixed the accidental contact of one commuter who'd stumbled as he tried to toss a quarter and then let Barry break his fall. Not to mention the bipolarly ill bag lady who got Barry Loach in a headlock and tried to bite his ear off near the end of the third week of the challenge. Barry L. refused to concede defeat and misanthropy, and the challenge dragged on week after week, and the older brother got bored eventually and stopped coming and went back to his room and waited for the St. John's Seminary administration to give him his walking papers. And Barry Loach had to take incompletes in the semester's training courses and got canned from his work-study job for not showing up. And he went through weeks and then months of personal spiritual crisis as passerby after passerby interpreted his appeal for contact as a request for cash and substituted abstract loose change for genuine fleshly contact. And some of the tea station's other disreputable STEM artists became intrigued by Barry's pitch, to say nothing of his net receipts, and started themselves to take up the cry of, "Touch me, please, please, someone," which of course further compromised Barry Loach's chances of getting some citizen to interpret his request literally and lay hands on him in a compassionate and human way. And Loach's own soul began to sprout little fungal patches of necrotic rot, and his upbeat view of the so-called normal and respectable human race began to undergo dark revision. And when the other scuzzy and shunned STEM artists of the downtown district treated him as a compadre and spoke to him in a collegial way and offered him warming drinks from brown-bagged bottles, he felt too disillusioned and coldly alone to be able to refuse, and, thus, started to fall in with the absolute silt at the very bottom of the Metro Boston socioeconomic duck pond. And then what happened with the spiritually infirm older brother, and whither he fared, and what happened with his vocation never gets resolved in the ETA Loach story, because now the focus becomes all Loach and how he was close to forgetting, after all these months of revulsion from citizens and his getting any kind of nurturing or empathetic treatment only from homeless and addicted STEM artists, what a shower or washing machine or a ligamental manipulation even were, much less career ambitions or a basically upbeat view of indwelling human goodness. And, in fact, Barry Loach was dangerously close to disappearing forever into the fringes and dregs of Metro Boston street life and spending his whole adult life homeless and louse-ridden and stemming in the Boston Common and drinking out of brown paper bags when, along toward the end of the ninth month of the challenge, his appeal, and actually also the appeals of the other dozen or so cynical STEM artists right alongside Loach, all begging for one touch of a human hand and holding their hands out, when all these appeals were taken literally and responded to with a warm handshake, which only the more severely intoxicated STEMmers didn't recoil from the profferer of, plus Loach, by ETA's own Mario Incandenza, who'd been sent dashing out from the Back Bay Co-op, where his father was filming something that involved actors dressed up as God and the Devil playing poker with tarot cards for the soul of Cosgrove Watt, using subway tokens as the ante, and Mario'd been sent dashing out to get another roll of tokens from the nearest station, which, because of a dumpster fire near the entrance to the Arlington Street station, turned out to be Park Street, and Mario, being alone and only 14, and largely clueless about anti-STEM defensive strategies outside tea stations, had no one worldly or adult along with him there to explain to him why the request of men with outstretched hands for a simple handshake or high five shouldn't automatically be honored and granted. And Mario had extended his claw-like hand and touched and heartily shaken Loach's own fuliginous hand, which led, through a convoluted but kind of heartwarming and faith-reaffirming series of circumstances, to Barry Loach, even without an official BA, being given an assistant trainer's job at ETA, a job he was promoted from just months later, when the then-head trainer suffered the terrible accident that resulted in all locks being taken off ETA's sauna's doors, and the sauna's maximum temperature being hardwired down to no more than 50 degrees centigrade. The inverted glass was the size of a cage or small jail cell, but it was still recognizably a bathroom-type tumbler, as if for gargling or post-brushing swishing, only huge and upside down on the floor, with him inside. The tumbler was like a prop or display. It was the sort of thing that would have to be made special. Its glass was green, and its bottom over his head was pebbled, and the light inside was the watery dancing green of extreme ocean depths. There was a kind of louvered screen or vent high on one side of the glass, but no air was coming out. In. The air inside the huge glass was pretty clearly limited as well, because there was already CO2 steam on the sides. The glass was too thick to break or to kick his way out, and it felt like he might have possibly broken the leg's foot already trying. There were some green and distorted faces through the glass's sides steam. The face at eye level belonged to the latest subject, the dexterous and adoring Swiss hand model. She stood looking at him, her arms crossed, smoking, exhaling greenly through her nose, then looking down to confer with another face, seeming to float at about waist level, that belonged to the shy and handicapped fan who Ode realized that shared the subject's Swiss accent. The subject behind the glass would meet Orin's eyes steadily, but did not acknowledge him or anything he shouted. When Ord had tried to kick his way out, was when he'd recognized that the subject was looking at his eyes, rather than into them, as previously. There were now smeared footprints on the glass. Every few seconds, Orin wiped the steam of his breath away from the thick glass to see what the faces were doing. His foot really was hurt, and the remains of whatever had made him fall asleep so hard really were making him sick to his stomach, and, in sum, this experience was pretty clearly not one of his bad dreams. But Orin, number 71, was in deep denial about its not being a dream. It was like the minute he'd come to and found himself inside a huge inverted tumbler, he'd opted to figure dream. The stilted amplified voice that came periodically through the small screen or vent above him, demanding to know, "Where is the master buried?" was surreal and bizarre and inexplicable enough to Orin to make him grateful. It was the sort of surreal, disorienting, nightmarish, incomprehensible but vehement demand that often gets made in really bad dreams. Plus the bizarre anxiety of not being able to get the adoring subject to acknowledge anything he said through the glass. When the speaker's screen slid back, Orin looked away from the glass's faces and up, figuring that they were going to do something even more surreal and vehement that would really nail down the undeniable dream status of the whole experience. Mademoiselle Luria P., who disdained the subtler aspects of technical interviews and had lobbied simply to be given a pair of rubber gloves and 2 or 3 minutes alone with the subject's testicles, and who was not really Swiss, had predicted, accurately, what the subject's response would be when the speaker's screen was withdrawn and the sewer roaches began pouring blackly and shinily through, and as the subject splayed itself against the tumbler's glass and pressed its face so flat against the absurd glass's side that the face changed from green to stark white, and, much muffled, shrieked at them, "Do it to her! Do it to her!" Luria P. inclined her head and rolled her eyes at the AFR leader, whom she had long regarded as something of a ham. Human beings came and went. An RN felt his forehead and yanked her hand back with a yelp. Somebody down the hall was jabbering and weeping. At one point, Chandler F., the recently graduated non-stick cookware salesman, seemed to be there in the classic resident confidier position, his chin on his hands on the bedside crib railing. The room's light was a glowing gray. The in-at-house house manager was there, fingering the place her missing eyebrow had been, trying to explain something about how Pat M. hadn't come because she and Mr. M'd had to kick Pat's little girl out of the house for using something synthetic again, and was in a too shaky place spiritually to even leave home. Gately felt physically hotter than he'd ever felt. It felt like a sun in his head. The crib-type railings got tapered on top and writhed a little like flames. He imagined himself on the house's aluminum platter with an apple in his mouth, his skin glazed and crispy. The MD that looked age 12 appeared with others, wreathed in mist, and said, "Up it to 30Q2, and let's try Doris."
385.
But the poor son of a bitch was burning down. He wasn't talking to Gately. The MD was not addressing Don Gately. Gately's only conscious concern was asking for help to refuse Demerol. He kept trying to say, addict. He remembered being young on the playground and telling Mara Duffy to look down her shirt and spell attic. Somebody else said ice bath. Gately felt something rough and cool on his face. A voice that sounded like his own brain voice, with an echo, said to never try and pull a weight that exceeds you. Gately figured he might die. It wasn't calm and peaceful like alleged. It was more like trying to pull something heavier than you. He heard the late Jean Fackelman saying to get a load of this. He was the object of much bedside industry. A brisk clink of IV bottles overhead, slosh of bags. None of the overhead voices talking to him. His input, unrequired. Part of him hoped they were putting Demerol in his IV without him knowing. He gurgled and mooed, saying, addict. Which was the truth, that he was, he knew. The crocodile that liked to wear Hanes, Lenny, that at the podium liked to say,
the truth will set you free, but not until it's done with you.
The voice down the hall was weeping like its heart would break. He imagined the ADA with his hat off, earnestly praying Gately would live so he could send him to MDC Walpole. The harsh sound he heard up close was the tape around his unshaved mouth getting ripped off him so quick he hardly felt it. He tried to avoid projecting how his shoulder would feel if they started pounding on his chest, like they pound on dying people's chests. The intercom calmly dinged. He heard conversing people in the hall passing the open door, and stopping for a second to look in, but still conversing. It occurred to him if he died, everybody would still exist, and go home, and eat, and ex their wife, and go to sleep. A conversing voice at the door laughed, and told somebody else it was getting harder these days to tell the homosexuals from the people who beat up homosexuals. It was impossible to imagine a world without himself in it. He remembered two of his Beverly High teammates beating up a so-called homosexual kid while Gately walked away, wanting no part of either side, disgusted by both sides of the conflict. He imagined having to become a homosexual in Walpole. He imagined going to one meeting a week and having a shepherd's crook and parrot and playing cribbage for a cigarette a point and lying on his side in his bunk, in his cell, facing the wall, jacking off to the memory of tits. He saw the ADA with his head bowed and his hat against his chest. Somebody overhead asked somebody else if they were ready, and somebody commented on the size of Gately's head and gripped Gately's head. And then he felt an upward movement deep inside that was so personal and horrible, he woke up. Only one of his eyes would open because the floor's impact had shut the other one up, plump and tight as a sausage. His whole front side of him was cold from lying on the wet floor. Fackelman, around somewhere behind him, was mumbling something that consisted totally of G's. His open eye could see the luxury apartment window. It was dawn outside, a glowing gray, and birds had plenty to say out in the bare trees. And at the big window was a face and a windmill of arms. Gately tried to adjust the vertical hold on his vision. Pamela Hoffman Jeep was at the window. Their apartment was on the second floor of the luxury complex. She was up in a tree, right outside the window, standing on a branch, looking in, either gesturing wildly or trying to keep her balance. Gately felt a rush of concern about her falling out of the tree, and was preparing to ask the floor to maybe, please, relax its hold a second, and let him go, when PHJ's face suddenly fell and exited the bottom of the window and was replaced by the face of Bobby C. C. Bobby C. raised a slow two-finger salute to his temple in an impassively mocking hello as he scanned the evidence of serious binging in the room. Through the window. Eyeballing Mount Dilaudid with special attention, nodding down to somebody down under the tree. He edged forward on the branch until he was right up flush with the window and pushed up on its frame with one hand, trying to open the locked window. The rising sun behind him cast a shadow of his head against the wet floor. Gately called out to Fackelman and tried to roll and sit up. His bones felt full of busted glass. Bobby C. held up a six-pack of Heffenreffer and waggled it suggestively, like wanting in. Gately had just managed to sit partly up when C's fist, in its fingerless glove, came through the window, spraying double-pane glass. The fallen teepee screen continued to show shots of small flames, Gately could see. C's arm came through and groped for the latch and raised the window. Fackelman was bleating like a sheep, but not moving. A syringe he hadn't bothered with removing hung from the inside of his elbow. Gately saw Bobby C had glass in his purple hair and a vintage Taurus PT-9mm jammed into his spike-studded belt. Gately sat there dumbly as C clambered on in and kind of tiptoed through the various puddles and rolled Fackelman's head back to check his pupils. C clucked his tongue and let Fackelman's head fall back against the wall, Fax still softly bleeding. He turned smartly on his boot's heel and started across toward the apartment door, and Gately sat there looking at him. When he got to where Gately was sitting on the floor, with his wet legs curved, parenthesized out in front of him, like some sort of huge, preverbal rugrat, C stopped, as if to say something he'd just remembered, looking down at Gately, his smile wide and warm, and Gately noticed he had a black front tooth, just as C caught him over the ear with a Taurus PT and put him back down. The floor got the back of Gately's head worse than the gun butt did. His ears belled. It wasn't stars, he saw. Then Bobby C kicked Gately in the balls. SOP to keep your man down. And Gately drew his knees up and turned his head and was sick out onto the floor. He heard the apartment door opening and the leisurely sound of C's boots going down the stairs to the complex's door. Between spasms, Gately urged Fackelman to go for the window as rickety-tick as he could. Fackelman was slumped back up against the wall. He was looking at his legs and saying he couldn't feel his legs, that he was numb from the scalp on down and climbing. C returned shortly, and at the head of a whole entourage-type group of people Gately didn't like the looks of at all. There was Dumont and Poincaré, Canadian Harvard Square small-time thug types, Gately knew slightly, small-time freelancers, too Canadianly dumb for anything but the brutalist work. Gately was unglad to see them. They wore overalls and non-matching flannel shirts. The poor, eczematic pharmacist's assistant guy was behind them, carrying a black doctor bag. Gately was on his back, pedaling his legs in the air, which is what anybody that's played organized ball knows is what you do for a Brody to the groin. The pharmacist's assistant stopped behind C and stood there looking at his own Ouijans. Three big, unfamiliar girls entered in red leather coats and badly laddered hose. Then, poor old Pamela Hoffman Jeep, her taffeta torn and stained and her face gray with shock, got borne in through the door by two Oriental punks in shiny leather jackets. They had their hands under her ass and carried her as if seated, one leg out, and a white stick of bone protruding from her shin, which her shin was a serious mess. Gately saw all this upside down, pedaling his legs until he could get up. One of the big girls carried an old-type graphics bong and a Glad cinch sack kitchen can bag. Either Poincaré or Dumont, Gately could never remember which of them was who, carried a case of bonded liquor. C asked generally if it was party time. The room brightened as the sun climbed. The room was filling up. Another of the girls made negative comments about the urine on the floor. Fackelman in the corner began saying it was all a goddamn lie. C pretended to answer himself in a falsetto and said, "Yes, indeedy-weedy, it was party time." Now, a very bland, groomed, college-ish guy in a Wembley tie entered, with a Tatung Corporation box, and put it down by where the pharmacist's assistant was still standing, and the bland guy rehung the teleplayer on the wall and ejected the TP's small flame cartridge, dropping it on the wet floor. The two Oriental toughs carried Pamela Hoffman Jeep over to a far corner of the living room, and she screamed when they dropped her onto a box of counterfeit little Commonwealth of Massachusetts peel-off seals. They were small, the Orientals, and they were looking down at him, but neither had bad skin. A small, grim woman with a tight gray bun and sensible shoes entered last and shut the apartment door behind her. Gately rolled slowly to his knees and stood up, still bent a bit at the waist, not moving, one eye still swollen shut. He could hear Fackelman trying to stand. PHJ stopped shrieking and blacked out and slumped down until her chin was on her chest and her ass half off the box. The room smelled like Dilaudid and urine and Gately's vomit and Fackelman's bowel movement and the red leather girl's fine leather coats. C came on over and reached up and put his arm around Gately's shoulders and stood with him like that while two of the tough girls in their coats passed around bottles of bourbon from the case. Gately could focus best when he squinted. The AM sun hung in the window, up and past the tree, yellowing. The bottles were the black-labeled boxy bottles that signified Jack Daniels. The church bell off in the square struck 7 or 8. Gately had had a bad experience with Jack Daniels at age 14. The bland, groomed corporate guy had inserted a different TP cartridge and now was getting a portable CD player out of the Tatung box, while the pharmacist's assistant watched him. Fackelman said whatever it was a total goddamn lie. Pointgrave or Demont took the bottle C had taken from the tough girls and handed to Gately. The sunlight on the floor through the window was spidered with shadows of branches. Everybody in the room's shadows were moving around on the west wall. C also held a bottle. Soon, just about everybody had their own individual bottle of Jack. Gately heard Fackelman asking somebody to open his for him. He was numb to the ceiling and climbing, and he couldn't feel his hands. A small, grim, librarianish woman went to Fackelman, removing her purse from her shoulder. Gately was figuring out what he was going to say on the Faxter's behalf when Whitey Sorkin arrived. Until then, he figured it was C's party, and just not to unnecessarily rile C. It seemed to take a long time to formulate mental thoughts. Pamela Hoffman Jeep's shin looked like ground chuck. C lifted his square bottle and asked for general permission to, like, propose a toast. PHJ's lips were blue with shock. Gately felt bad that he felt so little romantic concern now that she'd fallen out of the tree. He spent no time wondering if she'd ratted them out, or if she'd brought Bobby C to them, or vice versa. At least one of the girls in the red leather coats had an awful big Adam's apple for a girl. C roughly turned Gately's shoulders toward Fackelman in the corner and toasted to old friends and new friends, and what looked like a serious fucking A score for Gene the fax machine, given the size of this Dilaudid pile and all the evidence of some serious fucking partying they could see and smell. Everyone drank from their bottle. The grim-faced little woman had to help Fackelman find his mouth with the mouth of the bottle. All three of the big women displayed Adam's apples when they tilted way back to chug. The polite swallow of Jack almost made Gately heave. C's item in his belt pressed against Gately's thigh, and so did some of the belt's spikes. Dumont and Poincaré both had Smith & Wesson items in shoulder holsters. The Oriental punks didn't display any arms, but had a look about them like they didn't ever even shower unarmed. Safe bet they, at least, had little weird, sharp, chinky things you threw at people, Gately figured. Several of C's group chugged their whole bottle. One of the big girls hurled her bottle at the west wall, but it didn't break. Why is it you feel it in your gut, and not your nuts, per se, when you get brodied? Gately was turning and looking wherever C's arm was turning him. The contorted face on the rehung viewer from the corporate guy's cartridge was Whitey Sorkin's. A portrait Sorkin had let some neuralgic painter do of him, having a cluster headache, out at the National Craniofacial Pain Foundation in the city, for a series for an ad for aspirin. The cartridge seemed like just a continuous still of the painting, so that it looked like Sorkin on the wall was sort of presiding over the gathering in a mute, pained way. The librarianish little woman was threading a sewing needle with thread, her mouth real tight. The pharmacist's assistant was getting little skin flakes all over the black bag as he hunkered down over the bag, removing several syringes from the bag, and filling them out of a 2500 IU ampule, and handed them up to be passed around. The NCFPF painting had a red fist pulling a handful of brain out of the top of Sorkin's skull, while Sorkin's face looked out of the viewer with a classic migraine sufferer's look of super intense thought, almost more meditative than hurt-looking. One Oriental kid was squatting, chinkishly, in the corner drinking Jack, and the other was sweeping up spilled laminates off the floor, using a flap from the Tetung box for a dustpan. Chinks could do some serious sweeping, Gately reflected. Another of the girls threw her bottle at the wall. It was when C didn't even have Gately facing them that it dawned on Gately the girls in coats and slatternly hose were fags, dressed up as girls, like, as in, transvestals. Bobby C was beaming. The first bit of real personal-ass fear Gately felt was when he realized these people looked like mostly members of Bobby C's personal set, that they weren't the people Sorkin would dispatch if he was sending his own people and coming himself soon. That Sorkin's painting on the wall was symbolic of Sorkin wasn't coming. That Sorkin had given Bobby C free rein on this piece of painful business. The pharmacist's assistant removed two pre-filled syringes from the bag, unwrapping their crinkly plastic. C told Gately, quietly, how Whitey said to say he knew Donnie wasn't part of Fackelman's score to fuck Sorkin and 80s Bill. That he didn't need to do anything except kick back and enjoy the party and let Fackelman face his own music and to not let any, like, 19th century notions of defending the weak and pathetic drag Gately into this. C said he was sorry about the bit of the beating. He had to make sure Gately didn't try and get Fackelman out the window while he was down unlocking the door. That he hoped Gately wouldn't hold it against him, 'cause he wished him no particular ill and wanted no beef later. This was all said very quietly and intensively, while the two fags in wigs that had tried to break bottles were sitting on a box, filling the graphics' huge party bowl with grass from the Glad bag, which contained grass. Dumont sat in a director's chair. Everybody else was drinking out of their square bottle, standing around the sunny room in the awkward postures of way more people than seats. Their arms were pale and hairless. The two Oriental toughs were tying each other off. The draft through the fist hole in the window made Gately shiver. The other fag was making, like, comments about Gately's physique. Gately asked C, quietly, if he and Fackelman couldn't get cleaned up real quick, and they could all go see Sorkin together, and Whitey and Gene could reason together and work out an accord. Fackelman found his voice and asked loudly if anybody wanted to hike on over here to Mount Dilaudid and get fucking fucked up. Gately winced. Bobby C. smiled at Fackelman and said it looked like Fax had had about enough. But at the same time, the Syriatic assistant came to Fackelman and checked his pupils with a penlight and then shot him up with a prefilled, using an artery in his neck. The back of Fackelman's head hit the wall several times, his face flushing violently in the standard clinical reaction to Narcan.
386.
The pharmacist then came C in Gately's way. The portable CD player started in with poor old Linda McCartney as C held Gately and the assistant pharmacist tied him off with an MD's rubber strap. Gately stood there slightly hunched. Fackelman was making sounds like a long submerged man coming up for air. C told Gately to fasten his seatbelt. Urine had turned part of the apartment's luxury hardwood floor's finish soft and white, like soap scum. The CD playing was one C'd played all the fucking time in the car when Gately had been with him in a car. Somebody had taken an old disc of McCartney and the Wings, as in the historical Beatles' McCartney, taken and run it through a Kurzweil remixer and removed every track on the songs except the tracks of poor old Mrs. Linda McCartney singing back up and playing tambourine. When the fags called the grass Bob, it was confusing because they also called C Bob. Poor old Mrs. Linda McCartney just fucking could not sing. And having her shaky, off-key little voice flushed from the cover of the whole slick, multi-track corporate sound and pumped up to solo was, to Gately, unspeakably depressing. Her voice sounding so lost, trying to hide and bury itself inside the pro backup's voices. Gately imagined Mrs. Linda McCartney, in his staff room's walls picture, a kind of craggy-faced blonde, imagined her standing there, lost in the sea of her husband's pro noise, feeling low esteem and whispering off-key, not knowing quite when to shake her tambourine. C's depressing CD was past cruel. It was somehow sadistic-seeming, like drilling a peephole in the wall of a handicapped bathroom. Two of the transvestials were doing the swim